exactly support people? Of course, it depends on the matter, of course. But could you maybe give an example of, well, of course, as Abu Sita we already saw. But could you give us another example of something completely different that you did?
Yeah. So what happens is the, you know, different individual people just report to us and say, this has happened to me. I would like to request legal support. We then have both an in-house team of lawyers specialized in different areas of law, but also legal networks in all the countries that we work in. So lawyers that don't directly maybe work for us, but we work with them. They have expertise in, say, migration law, media law, and then we try and see what we can do in their case and try to support them as best as we can. And for example, when people receive letters because they posted something online that is then being valued as, you know, this or that, or the student encampments, for example, that are taking place right now, we're trying to also support them with getting legal kind of registrations, like as a registered protest. This, you know, we also protect the right to protest because it is a right. And even though the mayor of Amsterdam, and even though, you know, in Germany, in the UK, university presidents, mayors, and politicians try to suppress and silence these people, they have a right to protest, and they are on the right side of history. So that's kind of also the stuff we do.
Tobias Den Haan is a legal researcher with the European Legal Support Center. Read more about the work of the ELSC and support their work at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, you can also help our work with your assistance. We'll keep delivering stories about Earth systems, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Solidarity activists have been doxxed, smeared, fired, and arrested for years. October 7th moved the repression up a notch. Almost 3,000 students have been arrested on U.S. campuses in the course of peaceful protests. Here in Europe, no country is more hostile to free expression about the nature of the Israeli state and the fate of the perpetually subjugated Palestinian people than Germany. Here's one activist speaking this past Friday at the Rights Forum gathering about that Palestine Congress that got busted up in Berlin on May 12th. You'll also hear a Jewish activist named Wieland Hoband speaking about the deep roots of Germany's undying commitment to the Jewish state. You may be surprised. And Marloes van Noerloos, a professor at the Institute of Criminal Law and Criminology at the University of Leiden. Berber van der Vout moderates.
Yes, the Congress, I mean, everyone kind of saw what happened, I assume. We were violently stormed by the police. But the Congress itself also marked a shift, I think, in the repression we've been facing and the repression Palestinian boys have been facing, because the whole idea of the Congress is to get Palestinians together to speak, and it was a completely illegal thing. I mean, this event today is like legal as well, as the conference would be. But the government obviously didn't care that we were all like within our rights and still stormed it in complete like there's no legal basis for it, what they did, and it marked a shift, as in not only do they repress when we say something, but they repress now suddenly before we said something. And
what was their justification in the end for the way they acted, or was there no accountability anyway?
The official justification for why they banned it, what the police tweeted out afterwards, was that there was a risk of someone joining the conference who has said something anti-Semitic, and in the past, there was a risk of something being said. Like, it wasn't that something had been said. This is the justification for banning a three-day conference, and they banned it within 2 minutes of a speaker that they said had said something in the past. Like, Orwellian these justifications. And the next day, or I think 2 days after, our team Minister of Interior, Nancy Faeser, went out and said that it was an Islamist conference, even though Wieland was a co-organizer and was the face of the conference a lot of times. And it just, like, there was no sense in any of it in the end, but it didn't really matter for the government. And since then, they've also with the Sanab Sittas ban, there was no justification for it, and obviously as soon as you have it in front of court, it's revoked.
Is that something that you see a lot in the German rhetoric to suppress the intersection with the like anti-Islamist movements in the country?
Yeah, Germany has since October really went back to their Staatsraison, this reason of being of the German state. Since the Second World War, it said that because of Germany's because they did the Holocaust, now they have, like, the reason of state was suddenly after Second World War being to support the Jewish people and support the Israeli creation. And, like it was said before, the IHRA definition, which was adopted in Germany by the government, equates any anti-Zionist critique as anti-Semitic, and anti-Semitic critique is then pursuable by law, by the government. So really, I mean, yesterday we had a group in Duisburg, which, like an activist group, that was banned. Like, the whole organization was banned from any political work again, and most likely the members themselves will be legally prosecuted. And the justification, they said that it was anti-Semitic and that it was Israel haters. But that's the whole justification. This is two sentences for a whole organization of people that have been active since September or October to be banned. There's nothing further than these things of, oh, they're anti-Semitic, so that's it.
And I assume that it's a bit like, isn't there any pushback from Parliament? I assume that there are people that are worried about this, because it sounds quite disturbing that you can just ban organizations without having a justification, a legal justification, or is it like very, very quiet?
I think, for example, I think it was November or December, this group in Germany, Sami Dun, which was a network of Palestinians mainly who fought for Palestinian prisoners in Palestine. And they were banned, but the whole legal, whole political establishment jumped behind this banning of this group, because they said, well, they're Hamas supporters, so they deserve what basically happened to them. So, you know, Germany is very much behind thinking of, we can tolerate things until they support terrorism. And I assume it's going to be the same with this group again. Human rights, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly apply, like Hassan Abbasita said, to white people, basically. You know, to the general society, but not to the brown, not to brown bodies, because they're not seen as full people under that law. What I would say is, for the conference that was banned, that marked a shift again in the rhetoric of political establishment. We had politicians that were against what we, political messaging, but then said what the government did in the conference, that was markedly too far. That we had people that before the conference said, you know, we're Israel haters, we're this, we're that, we had even Zionists, and who afterwards said, okay, we hate those people, but what you did to them, that was too far, because it infringes on everyone's fundamental rights all of a sudden. And it creates precedence.
Right, absolutely, yeah. I would like to go to Wieland, because you, when we were preparing this session, we talked about you as being Jewish, and the strange dynamics that occur in the, like, the weaponization, basically, of the fight against anti-Semitism. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, this weaponization has been taking place not only in Germany, of course, in the UK and the US, It's been a major force, especially in connection with the IHRA definition. And I think the meaning of the very term has become eroded in such a way that it hardly serves any purpose anymore, except a bad faith purpose. And it's reached the point where I think probably statistically, if you were to look at a handful of anti-Semitism accusations that have come up and see, okay, how many of these are based on statements about Israel? And it's clear that it will be the vast majority. And there's a complete double standard also in how speech relating to, let's say, the broad complex of Israel, Jews, how these are treated depending on the political context. So any harsh criticism of Israel will be deemed anti-Semitic, or, well, first of all, will be taken as a statement about Jews, because you say, okay, Israel stands for Jews, it's the Jewish state, it is. Some people have even used the collective Jew as a term. I find that a very unpleasant term. But in any case, they will first of all say, okay, when people say Israel, what they really mean is Jews. You know, so there's always this element of kind of insinuation and suspicion, saying that everything is a dog whistle, basically. And then, you know, whereas when you have far-right affiliations among, say, conservative politicians, which normally have anti-Semitic elements as well, as you would expect on the far right, then one doesn't see anywhere near the same level of outrage or also scrutiny from the authorities and the media. So really then what this shows is that it's not really about Jews, or certainly not about all Jews. It's really more about Israel. And if one understands a bit also about the political and historical context of what Israel means in Germany, then actually you come to realize that it's also about Germany itself. So that attacks on Israel are seen by the system, and in a sense they are actually also attacks on Germany.
That's interesting. Can you just take us one step further in that reasoning? Because I think that there are also, like, this happens in the Netherlands, we are quite similar, I think, to what happens in Germany. But what do you mean exactly by attacks on Israel? It's an attack on us Germans?
Well, there's some more general and more specific aspects to this. So at the general level, we have this whole narrative, okay, we all know the slogan, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. And what that really means is that it's the last remaining Western colony in the Middle East. And so in that sense, an ideologically motivated attack on Israel is an attack on Western imperialism, first of all. And then, in the case of Germany, it's also an attack on a kind of a hypocritical culture of moral atonement and supposed historical responsibility in the wake of the Holocaust. And in what I really want to emphasize is that this is the cover story, you know, and this is what a lot of ordinary people believe. But it's not what actually motivates the ruling class and the government. And a Jewish comrade in Berlin recently put it very succinctly. He said, it's not about Auschwitz, it's about NATO. But so that's the general Western aspect. But in Germany, the idea actually since the 1950s has been, how do we rehabilitate Germany after this real moral shame after the Holocaust? Because it wasn't just a matter of losing a war, it was really a matter of losing standing. And you're thinking, you know, this idea of Germany is, you know, the country of, I don't know, you know, Bach, Mozart, Goethe, whatever. You know, there's this phrase in Germany, the country of poets and thinkers, right? All these noble values, etc. And then they carry out this Holocaust. So there was this incredible shame. And the first chancellor after the war, Konrad Adenauer, he worked out that an important kind of fast-track route to being a player on the international stage again would be to establish good ties with Israel. And, you know, he didn't do that out of particular, I wouldn't say love for Jews. He in fact said that one should not underestimate the influence of the Jews, which is the sort of statement one might expect to hear from people who don't like Jews very much. But he saw that then establishing ties with Israel and already from the 1950s selling arms to Israel and paying reparations, that this was a way for Germany to look better after the years of shame. And that's been really internalized by the political establishment, sometimes more under the surface, sometimes more visibly. And I think really since the 80s, I mean, it had become a bit more of just a standard way of functioning, but then from the 80s, people started really being demonstrative about it again. And, you know, saying that this is our great moral responsibility, you know, and all this sort of rhetoric. And, yeah, unfortunately, there are ordinary people who believe that, who don't see just the cynicism and the national or imperialist interest behind it. You know, Germany is still the second biggest arms supplier to Israel. You know, they make a lot of money out of their supposed guild. And but yeah, there are a lot of people though. If you speak to them, you know, you can still, I guess, depending on their age. You know, people in their 20s, of course, it's further away for them. But you can still sort of activate this sense of responsibility. And among those who just aren't so informed, or maybe just who censor their own thoughts a bit more, there's still this feeling that they can't really attack Israel in any substantive way, that, you know, or at least not as Germans, that maybe they understand if other people do, but they don't feel that they have the right as Germans to say certain things or even to think certain things. There's a great culture of obedience in Germany.
Yeah, well, thank you. This is very, very interesting. And it must be such a difficult place for you to navigate. You are Jewish, but you are also like anti-Zionist. It's a bit of a stupid question maybe in these times, but do you feel safe? How is it with your feelings of safety?
Well, I think safety is always relative. And, you know, generally the people who get arrested most at these demonstrations are not usually the ones with the lightest skin. So, you know, part of our job also, I mean, as an organization, as activists, is to point this out and to point out also that the struggle for Palestinian rights is part of the international anti-racist struggle, that this is not just a particularist issue, because that's one of the big problems also in the German understanding of anti-Semitism, that often it doesn't lead to any kind of introspection about, you know, racial, ethnic discrimination. It's just taken as this particular issue because that's the one that has been treated as most important in German history. You know, whereas most people, they couldn't care less about the Namibian genocide, for example, because those were black Africans, and it wasn't happening in Europe. And I mean, and I'm pretty sure that if the Holocaust had only been carried out against Eastern European Jews, who are more religious, more traditional, you know, wearing the traditional, with the traditional appearance. I think also that the West would have cared less about that as well than about, you know, these more obviously white, middle class, Western Jews.
They were more exotic Jews, like...
Yeah, more racialized, you might say.
Right, yes, yeah. Thank you, this is really interesting. I would like to go to Marloes, because you can maybe... Like, what I hear a lot from actually what happened the whole afternoon is there's a lot of legal muddy waters, right? And there's, like, very firm action, but basically with a very vague legal basis. What are your reflections on that, as, like, with a legal point of view?
Yes, thank you. So to start with, I think indeed when you look at the right to freedom of expression, also as the European Court of Human Rights, a very important body in that respect, as it interprets this right, in a very famous case from a few years ago, Baldassi, they have made it very clear that there is a right to boycott. This was a case about BDS activists boycotting Israeli products in supermarkets, and they were prosecuted for incitement to discrimination. The European Court did not accept this and found a violation of the right to freedom of expression, because it's very important to be able to protest, especially gross human rights violations, and people have to be able to stand up against that and not being criminalized. And this has been quite a revolutionary development, because earlier case law by the same court was less progressive, so to say. So now we have quite a clear legal development here. However, what you see in reality, indeed, and as we've seen with Gassan's ban as well, it's so easy to ban people and to fight these bans. It takes time, and it takes legal action. And once the legal action is fortunately successful, then much harm has already been done. Smear campaigns, etc. It goes on so many different fronts. Bank accounts that do not work anymore, etc. And as a background to all of these developments, on the one hand, indeed, had a weaponization of anti-Semitism, as you rightfully pointed out, with the IHRA definition. I'm not sure if everybody is aware of what the definition is, but it's basically a definition by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance of Antisemitism. It was meant to strengthen the fight against antisemitism by providing quite a vague definition with some examples, and also pointing out that harsh criticism of Israel, if other countries are not criticized in the same way, then that might point to antisemitism. But the whole definition was never meant by its makers to be used for legal purposes, because it is too vague for that. But it's been promoted around the world by Israel and its allies, and used in ways that stifle free speech. So that's one element, and I think actually this weaponization of anti-Semitism in this way doesn't help the actual fight against anti-Semitism, which is very important. So there's been some developments. It's interesting, the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism is an alternative kind of definition made by scholars and organizations, which does a much better job in many respects, although you can still think about other definitions. But I am afraid that this whole vague definition and all of the developments from Israel that come with it have already led to so much damage. But I hope there is room for, for thinking in a different way about, fighting anti-Semitism now. Another related development, I think, in the legal sphere has been the fight against terrorism since 9/11 especially has led to very harsh laws in all kinds of fields over the whole world, also in Europe and in many European countries, in EU law as well, where not just terrorist acts are criminalized, which is course logical, but also a very broad range of expressions, including expressions such as glorification of terrorism, and these kinds of laws are now, they have always been used very much, I think, against what is called Islamic terrorism, to target Muslim speech, and at this moment I think these kinds of laws are also very much behind many of these legal campaigns. And like the Schengen information system, for instance, with the ban that Ghassan was a victim of. These kinds of systems also use these very broad definitions of terrorism, including all these kinds of expressions, so that almost everything falls under terrorism at a certain point, and you can use it in very broad ways. Fortunately, the ban was lifted now, but I'm not optimistic about how these systems can work in the future.
In order of appearance, you heard a Berlin activist named Nabil, Wieland Hoband, a British-German composer and translator and co-founder of the German group Jüdische Stimme, Jewish Voice for Just Peace in the Middle East. Read more about Jüdische Stimme, the Rights Forum, and all the other folks you heard in this edition at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, you already know it, but I'm going to repeat it. The guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For farm workers, toiling outside in the summer heat can be dangerous. Extreme heat can lead to headaches, dizziness, and even death. And as the climate warms, the risks will grow.
We all know that record-breaking temperatures are now becoming much more common.
Judge Laura Safer Espinoza helps run the Fair Food Program, a partnership between workers, growers, and more than a dozen large food buyers. The program protects thousands of workers on participating farms from workplace hazards while defending their wages and rights. A few years ago, it added protections against heat stress. From April to November, farm workers now have to take breaks every 2 hours. Espinoza says the mandate prevents people from feeling pressure to keep working even when they need to cool down.
This requires everyone across the field to stop and to rest, to hydrate.
Supervisors also have to watch for any workers who show signs of heat illness and provide them with immediate relief. As the risk of extreme heat grows, these heat stress protections will help keep the workers who are covered by the Fair Food Program safe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.